Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XXXII, Vespasian as prophesied. In the last episode of Emperors of Rome, we learnt of the origin of Vespasian, an effective military leader who seems satisfied with his career. So what could make such a man enter the civil war and try and become the next emperor? And how could somebody of the equestrian rank have a valid claim? Sounds to me like somebody needs a prophecy or two, or three, or four.
We have lots of signs recorded that show that Vespasian was meant to be emperor. And some of them are quite outstanding. Things like his mother noticed that a tree grew certain branches when each of her children was born. And the one that grew when her daughter was born, the daughter didn't live very long, was withered and died very quickly. And the one that grew when Sabinus, her elder son, was born, became quite strong and vigorous. But the one that grew when Vespasian was born became practically its own tree. So this idea that he is going to be outstanding, he's going to be somebody who grows outside of his own status.
She laughed that off, didn't she, though?
Yes, and she seems to have been quite cynical about Vespasian having any future, kind of hassling him, trying to get him to work harder, but clearly not believing that he ever really would make it anywhere.
So Vespasian had the support of a tree?
He did, and apparently not the active support of his mother. I think if we can psychoanalyze, which is always dangerous, ancient people, then you could say, I think, that this made Vespasian quite tough. He kind of acts on his own resources, his own initiative, because he's very kind of practical and down to earth, and that's very clear from all of the sources. There are other slightly grotesque things, like a dog coming and dropping a human hand at his feet, which I think you could read in all sorts of bizarre ways, and the Romans typically see it as a sign of power, that he will have, the power of the hand.
Right.
They read a lot into dead bodies. They practice types of divination where they look at the dead bodies of animals and can tell the future from that. But when you find parts of a human, that's often seen as a sign of something very significant. So, for example, the Capitol Hill is supposed to be named after a human head being found in there when they dug the foundations of the Temple of Jupiter. Right, and that means Rome's going to be the head of the world, according to the Romans.
Right.
This hand being dropped in front of him is a sign of power. The hand is that sign. So things like when you set a slave free, you manumit them. That's got the word hand in it, manus. So the hand has power, and that's what we're getting there. He also has what you might think of as a kind of behavior we'd more associate with a religious leader, although, of course, for the Romans, political and religious leaders are often the same people, in that he has healing powers. Now, we don't hear of this very often amongst Roman leaders. It's more something we'd associate with someone like Christ. But Vespasian is supposed to have cured both a blind man and a man with a withered limb by spitting in the eyes of the blind man and standing on the withered limb, and they were both cured. So he has these kind of supernatural powers.
Now, Suetonius and Tacitus both describe this scene, and they both play up how reluctant Vespasian was to believe that he could do something like this, and he kind of dismissed even trying it for quite a while until he was peer pressured into having a go, wasn't he?
Well, you can see that it might be a dangerous thing to do if it doesn't work, because then it shows you're powerless.
Yeah.
Which is something that leaders often play with. I mean, there's the famous instance of the English king Canute asking the sea to stop coming in, the tide, and he couldn't do it. And that showed that he was a man. He wasn't divine. Vespasian is trying not to be shown just as an ordinary person, I suppose, and it could all go terribly wrong. You could imagine all kinds of fanciful ways in which this might have worked, like he might not really have been a blind man, it was all a setup, being put together by Vespasian's followers. I think a lot of this is part and parcel of the fact that Vespasian isn't an automatic shoe-in for the emperorship. He doesn't come from the Julio-Claudian family. He doesn't even come from a very aristocratic family. So these are ways of making it clear that Vespasian was meant to be emperor.
And that's something that he believes himself as well, isn't it? That he's from that humble a background that he's got no claim to this kind of stake. At least that's the impression that we've been left with.
Exactly. He makes no bones about the fact that he doesn't come from the family of the emperors. So we have anecdotes like at his triumph, he's given a triumph when he comes back from Jerusalem, even though he's left Titus there to finish the job. He gets kind of bored. Triumph lasts a long time. And of course, it would be an insult to just, you know, get up and walk away from the triumph or make fun of it. So he kind of uses a defense mechanism. He takes the accusation onto himself and says, you know, what right did I think I had to have a triumph when I'm just this fairly humble person? Which is a good way of deflecting any criticism, perhaps, that he's not the kind of person who should have a triumph. The triumph has very much become the place for the imperial family now. So you might be a military leader, you might have a great victory, but you probably won't get a triumph unless you're part of the imperial family. And it's a way of deflecting criticism that this is a new dynasty. They're nouveaux. They've come from nowhere. This is the case for all of the emperors, however. They're more likely to be signs and portents that the emperor is about to die. It's not only Vespasian that has stories about events that happen that people subsequently interpret as he was meant to be emperor. It happened particularly with Claudius, another unexpected emperor, even though he's part of the Julio-Claudian family. No one expected him to get to that rank because he was seen as deformed and stupid. So I think that it's a way that the Romans kind of rationalize these unexpected rises to power.
But possibly at this point, he was the one who needed it the most.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In a way, Vespasian is the most unexpected emperor because everybody else previously has been related to Augustus or to Livia and usually adopted into the Augustan family, even if they were only related to Livia as Tiberius was. And after that, Vespasian has set the precedent. I guess you could say that the other three emperors of the Year of the Four Emperors have as well, but they're so short-lived that it could look like anyone from outside the Julio-Claudian family is going to be deposed very quickly. Vespasian is the one that is emperor for 10 years, which is a good solid period, especially as he's quite elderly when he comes to be emperor. And he also forms a dynasty. That's a really difficult thing to do, and it shows us just how competent an administrator and leader he is.
Were there any other signs that Vespasian was to be emperor?
There's a great one during a battle during the civil wars in which two eagles are seen in the sky fighting one another. And this is at the point at which Otho and Vitellius are at war against one another, so the two emperors before Vespasian. So they're fighting each other, these two eagles, and another eagle comes in from the east. Remember, Vespasian is in the east, he's in Judea, and defeats them both. So this is an obvious parallel for exactly what's going to happen with Vespasian. There's a civil war already going on, and he's going to come and take advantage of that and defeat the second one, defeat Vitellius, and take the emperorship for himself.
And eagles being, well, at the top of a standard and everything, they're clear signs of imperial Rome, clear symbols.
Exactly. They are the Roman symbol of power. They're on the standard, the symbol of Jupiter as well. So it couldn't be any more clear that this represents imperial power, even divinity.
So now that the signs have said that Vespasian's going to be emperor, how does he go about it? Well, how is it handed to him?
Well, Vespasian doesn't march straight for Rome. He's quite a long way away, for one thing. But he has forces that turn to his side, and he's got a son left in the city. Remember, he has two sons, Titus, who has been called to Judea.
And is left behind to clean up that conflict?
Yes, exactly. Titus is left in Judea. Vespasian leaves Judea, and he actually moves via Egypt to come back towards Rome. This is probably in part because Egypt is quite an important and powerful province. You don't want to lose that one, and it's rich. So if you can keep Egypt on side, you can provide for Rome in terms of food, and that's really significant. So he needs to go via Egypt, and he knows that meanwhile back in Rome, his other son Domitian is there to sort of finish off the civil war for him. Something that we'll come back to when we look at Domitian, because he'll eventually be emperor too. And it's a pretty bloody civil war, this finishing off of Vitellius, and it's very destructive of Rome. So Domitian and Vespasian's brother Sabinus are caught up in this civil war, but it, of course, as we know, it ends with the death of Vitellius and triumph for Vespasian's troops. But he's not actually there at that moment.
So when does he get there, and what sort of situation is Rome once he enters it?
It's not going to be an entirely happy city because it's suffered three rounds of civil war. It's a war zone, so a lot of it has been destroyed. The Temple of Jupiter on the Capitol has been burnt down.
Again,
yes, it periodically does, often because of fires that are started by accident, but this time something much more violent and self-destructive. And the Romans have a lot of civil wars, but at the same time, they feel that this is something unnatural. They should be fighting foreigners, not themselves. So it would be a very fraught psychological state. And when Vespasian comes back, he has to deal with some of Vitellius's troops who've survived. And he decommissions them. He doesn't try to integrate them into his own army. He kind of tries to send them away. So he doesn't have them executed. He doesn't seem to take out revenge on those who had backed others. But he has this tense situation to deal with. And he also has a city that has been burnt and, there are bodies everywhere, so there's probably health problems. He needs to put money into the city. He needs to rebuild it.
If I can quote at the start of Tacitus, Book 4 of the Histories, he says that the execution of Vitellius marked the end of hostilities rather than the beginning of peace. So it sounds like there was still a lot of tension in Rome as well.
It's a very Tacitus kind of thing to say, to play with words in
that way.
It's
an awesome little wordplay. That's why I wanted to read it.
But it also says something about the Latin words for war and peace. So the word for peace is pax, which literally means a pact. All right. So it's a peace that you have brought about by ending a war. So the word peace itself is interesting because it doesn't mean quite what we would think, which is this state of, I guess, this state of harmony. It doesn't really mean harmony. It means something that's been imposed, something you've had to bring in and make a pact about. It's something you can only have after war, really, after conflict. The idea is we haven't even got this. We haven't even got this pact. And so it's hard work for Vespasian. He doesn't just swan in to, and I guess none of them does after a war. Augustus doesn't either. He doesn't just swan into a situation where he's now in charge and he can do what he wants. He has to play it very, very carefully.
Once he's gone in there and he's had his unsatisfactory triumph, how does he consolidate his power then? How does he go about rebuilding, or at least trying to get things back to a sense of normality? Because that's a pretty traumatic year for the city. There's probably a lot of people going, okay, how long are you going to last?
Exactly.
What does he do?
He plays it very, very well. He tries to please the Senate. And in fact, I don't think this is him pretending that he wants to do that. Remember, he's not from a senatorial background. They might not automatically feel any kind of allegiance to him. But he makes sure that the Senate is respected. Now, Nero hadn't done this, and Nero is the emperor he kind of sets himself against, I suppose, most. So if Vespasian is saying anything, it's that I'm not Nero, and he does that in lots of clever ways. One of them is he brings in rules like equestrians and others aren't allowed to start a conflict with a senator. They're not allowed to abuse them in the street. And he puts in a little clause that says, if the senator starts it off, if he starts abusing someone else, then that's okay.
Right.
So you can see how this is trying to keep everyone pleased, but at the same time, it's recognizing the authority of senators. He doesn't have senators executed, generally, which is always a good thing to do. Mind you, most emperors who come in say they're going to do that, and then they break it.
Okay, so I'd say that'd go down well with the senators.
Absolutely.
If he did that, yeah.
He also makes promises to the people, and he is quite generous from the top to the bottom. So again, with senators, those who might have lost money, which is very typical of civil war, you might lose property, he makes up their property. He gives them money so they can stay in the Senate because that's a property qualification. So if you go under a million sesterces of property, you're no longer in the Senate. Well, he gives you a top up so you can be. But he also puts on shows for the people and he rebuilds the city. So, for example, the Temple of Jupiter, Optimus Maximus, the best and the greatest, the most important Temple of Jupiter, the one on the Capitoline Hill, which has been destroyed in the Civil War, he pays for that to be rebuilt. That's kind of a no-brainer that you have to do that. Half pays for it and half the Senate pays for it. But he kind of symbolically carries out some of that building by carrying away some of the rubble. He's the first one to go there and do it. It's a bit like when you see someone sort of getting a trowel and
turning the soil at the
building
site.
Yeah, exactly,
kind of thing.
For a building site or for planting a tree or whatever it is. I don't think we should imagine that Vespasian is actively engaged in carrying out the clear up of the city, but he makes a kind of prominent play of this, something that's visible for people. And the Capitoline Hill is, you know, it's a high hill in Rome. Everyone can see this happening. On the other hand, Vespasian is a very practical kind of person. Mm. Remember, his whole career has been in the military. And that is the way he comes over as this practical soldier. And one of the ways that he wins people over is by not having a particularly luxurious personal life. So he's spending a lot of money on the city, and that means he's got to raise a lot of taxes, and that makes him unpopular in lots of quarters of the empire. But you can sort of save yourself from that if you don't live a luxurious life yourself. So he lives in a fairly modest way. He chastises other people who live extravagantly. There's a great story about how somebody he's just given a job to, a magistracy, comes along to thank him, and they smell of really expensive perfumes. And he takes the job away from them. He's not interested in giving it to somebody with, as he sees it, that both extravagance and also probably effeminacy.
Yeah.
He seems like a very kind of manly, full of bluster kind of guy, I think.
But another way that he gets everybody on side is by taking up new building projects, not just rebuilding. So we get the beginning of the Flavian Amphitheatre and the Temple of Peace.
Yes.
And the spoils of war really help out in both those circumstances, don't they?
He has got a lot of spoils from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And that, plus the raising of the taxes, means that he has got money and he spends it on public spaces. And I think that we must think here that he is using Augustus as his model. And why wouldn't you? He's the last really popular emperor in many ways. Augustus had this big building program for the city of Rome, built of brick and left it built of marble. And Vespasian decides to do the same. And there is actually a reference to Augustus in Suetonius when Vespasian decides to build an amphitheatre, that he had heard this was a project of Augustus.
Mm.
So he's actually carrying out something from that period. So he starts the building of the amphitheatre, which we think of as the Colosseum. He's not there to see it finished. It takes a long time, takes a decade. It is his son who will actually open it in 80 CE, which is the year after Vespasian dies. Nevertheless, he can be very strongly associated with it, and it gets called the Flavian Amphitheatre after his family name. He also builds the Temple of Peace, which is sometimes called the Forum of Vespasian. It's sort of one in a line of imperial fora. So Julius Caesar had built one.
Augustus had built one.
Mm. And now Vespasian builds one, which is not quite in the same format, hence it's sometimes called the Temple of Peace. It's very, very grand. The Elder Pliny lists it as one of the most spectacular locations to go visit in the world.
Mm.
And he puts the Forum of Augustus in there too. Because it's built with beautiful marbles from all across the Roman Empire, it would have looked amazing. It would have looked rich and lavish, but it's a religious space and it's a public space. It's not like building a big palace like Nero did with the Domus Aurea. And indeed, he's taking spaces from the Domus Aurea and turning them into his own projects. So as I think we might have mentioned elsewhere when we talked about Nero or the Domus Aurea, it's the lake area of the Domus Aurea, the Golden House, that gets turned into the Colosseum or the Flavian Amphitheatre. So it's reclaiming what you could depict as personal spaces of Nero and making them public spaces. Another thing he does with regard to building, which might seem weirdly like it's stretching back in time, is he finishes the temple of Claudius. Claudius had been deified when he died, and that means he needs to have a temple. And Nero starts building one, but he loses interest,
yeah.
And it gets turned into a sort of fountain house. Now, Vespasian is very clever. He associates himself, I've said, partly with Augustus, but very strongly with Claudius. He had links with Claudius. His son had been educated with Claudius's son Britannicus.
And he fought for Claudius in yep. Britannic.
He'd himself. Been there in Britannia for the invasion. So he's got those links and he stresses them. Also, Claudius might not have been the most popular emperor, but in comparison with Nero, whose crimes are more recent and more in the memory, he's somebody who can be recuperated. So if he can make those links back to an acceptable Julio-Claudian, that makes him look like somebody who has more right to be in that position, given that he's come from nowhere.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in iTunes. Please leave us a review there and tell your friends about it. We've now got about 300 reviews on iTunes from 7 different countries. Believe me, we read and appreciate every one of them. Emperors of Rome has a companion podcast called When in Rome. You can find that on iTunes and SoundCloud. Episode III has just been released and it's all about gladiators and it's listener supported. So consider giving your support on patreon.com/whenInRome. We've also got a Facebook page where I've made note that Emperor Vespasian bears an uncanny resemblance to the actor Terry O'Quinn. So come there, give us a like, and feel free to agree or disagree with my casting choices. Also on our Facebook page are cartoons of the emperors from the Civil War by Canadian storyboard artist Rich Morris. He also writes and illustrates yet another fantasy gamer comic and the Rome set House of Paulus, and we've got links to both of those on Facebook. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we look at the rule of Emperor Vespasian and what the Roman people think of him, which, if you want a bit of a preview, liked ruler, not too pretentious, GSOH. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.